secret flight from Tehran, carrying two worried passengers. Uri Lebrani, Israel's ambassador to Iran, and Reuven Merhav, the Mossad station chief in Iran. They were on their way to meet His Imperial Majesty, Mohammad Reza Cyrus Pahlavi Shah, who was at his vacation residence on the island of Kish, 10 miles off the Iranian shore in the Persian Gulf. The Shah was Iran's omnipotent ruler, a ruthless, megalomaniacal despot who wanted to transform his country rapidly into a land more developed than France. He invested Iran's huge oil revenues in the establishment of a powerful army, the construction of up-to-date infrastructure, and a modern economy. He imposed an accelerated process of westernization on his subjects, something that many of them, from the merchants in the Great Bazaar of Tehran to the Muslim clerics, found offensive and detrimental. But their objections didn't faze the Shah, and he ordered the army and his brutal secret service, Savak, to suppress any opposition with an iron fist. The Shah's foreign policy was based on close political, military, and civil links with the United States. He also formed an intimate intelligence alliance with Israel. This led to Iran acquiring a great deal of military weaponry and equipment from the Jewish state, in exchange for both cash and oil. He also allowed the Israelis to stage a number of important operations against Arab states from Iranian soil. But Lebrani and Merhav had good reason to be perturbed. While Iran's links with the United States and Israel were as strong as they'd ever been, the Shah's rule over his country was beginning to crumble. The demonstrations against him were getting more intense by the day, and protest movements from all sides, merchants, communists, right-wingers, Islamists, were gaining power. The White House, which had hitherto turned a blind eye to the Shah's human rights violations, was now run by liberal President Jimmy Carter, and began to display increasing discomfort at the use of force against protesters, which led to the Shah's being reluctant to deploy his army against them. Iran's royal family and leadership did not put any checks on their lavish lifestyle, however. Soon after landing on the island of Kish, Lebrani and Merhav were witness to this. The island was the Shah's favorite residence, the location of his headquarters during parts of the year. "It was the playground for all the top people," says Merhav. "Evidence of the astonishing corruption was everywhere. We were shocked by the hedonistic atmosphere, the extravagance." The two Israelis had come to Kish to meet the Shah and his close advisors, in order to evaluate the strength of the regime in the face of the mounting opposition. Fueling their concern was the fact that extremist Shiite elements, the most important component of the opposition, had linked up with their brethren in Lebanon and had begun training in camps set up for them by Yasser Arafat. "That combination," said Merhav, "between what was then perceived as the main terrorist force operating against us, Arafat's PLO in Lebanon, and the extremist Shiites, seemed to us to have significant potential dangers." The most prominent leader of the religious opposition was Ruhollah Khomeini, who bore the hereditary title Sayyid, meaning Lord, used only by descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, and had earned the highest Shiite clerical rank, Grand Ayatollah. As a young man in his family's hometown of Khomeini, the future revolutionary was a well-known preacher, acutely expert in the intricacies of the faith, but lacking in charismatic oratory. In 1962, however, at age 60, Khomeini underwent a dramatic change. After a period of seclusion, he emerged from his bedchamber convinced that he had been visited by the Archangel Gabriel, God's special messenger, who had told him that Allah had destined him for great things. To accomplish his mission, Khomeini transformed. He abandoned his hitherto complex style and began to speak simply, never using more than 2,000 words and repeating certain phrases over and over again until they took on the sound of magical incantations. "Islam is the solution," was one of his favorites. He began to portray the world as a clash between good and evil. The evil must be uprooted and destroyed, a duty that had to be performed by the good, who were both judges and executioners. His followers among the poor found this persuasive. Later on, Khomeini reshaped Shiite Islam to conform with the leadership role he had designed for himself. He shook off the basic separation of civil and religious authority that had always prevailed in the Muslim empires, and declared that there was no longer a need for a king advised by religious sages. The government should be in the hands of the sages themselves. All of the monarchies and the other regimes in the Muslim world that were not manifestly religious, the presidents of Egypt and Syria, the king of Saudi Arabia, and the Shah of Iran, were illegitimate and had to be replaced. Islam is the only solution, he decreed. Khomeini's attitude on the issue of martyrdom was also meant to prepare the ground for his assumption of power. He explained to his supporters that the highest sanction in the hands of the state was the power to execute its citizens. Take this sanction away by changing death to a desired reward, and the state becomes powerless. "Please kill us," Khomeini proclaimed and wrote, "for we too are going to kill you." He would later instruct the bereaved families of martyrs and their neighbors to hold joyous celebrations to mark the deaths of their sons in Iran's holy war. Khomeini's next step was to shatter the most important traditional custom of Shiite theology. He allowed the believers, even encouraged them, to call him Imam, a term in the Shiite tradition that is largely similar in meaning to the Judeo-Christian concept of the Messiah, whose advent heralded the end of days. In 1963, a short time after formulating his new doctrine, Khomeini launched an open campaign against the Shah from Qom, Iran's holiest city. The Shah couldn't risk killing the Ayatollah, so instead he was exiled. Khomeini found refuge in Turkey, Iraq, and finally France. The lessons he taught there attracted more and more students. During the 1970s, he became, from afar, the most powerful of the Shah's opponents. By the time Loubrani and Merhav came to Kish, Khomeini had already flooded Iran with an estimated 600,000 cassette tapes of his sermons. In the mosques and the markets, in rural regions and on the mountains surrounding Tehran, in the bazaars and even very quietly, in government offices. Many millions were listening to the incendiary preaching of the fanatical, stern-faced cleric. They heard him say things like, "The despised Shah, that Jewish spy, the American snake, whose head must be crushed with a stone," or, "The Shah says that he is giving the people freedom. Listen to me, you puffed-up toad. Who are you to grant liberty? It is Allah who grants liberty. It is the law that grants liberty. It is Islam that grants liberty. It is the Constitution that grants liberty. What do you mean when you say you have granted us liberty? What gives you the ability to grant anything at all? Who do you think you are?" The distribution of the Khomeini cassettes was observed, of course, by the watchful eyes of the Savak, the Shah's secret service. The organization's leaders asked the Shah for permission to raid the Ayatollah's distribution centers, but the request was refused because of President Carter's pressure to refrain from violating civil rights and the weakness and confusion that the Shah was suffering from due to the cancer treatment he was undergoing. Loubrani and Merhav were not aware of the Shah's illness, which was a well-kept secret. Only Loubrani was granted an audience. The Shah welcomed him warmly, but the ambassador soon realized that the conversation would go nowhere. Loubrani left the magnificent, gilt-decorated chamber in a somber mood. The Shah is detached from reality, living in a world of his own, almost delusional, he told Merhav. He is surrounded by sycophants who don't tell him the truth about the situation in the country. Merhav's meetings with the heads of Iranian intelligence led him to the same conclusions. Soon after the visit, the two transmitted a warning to the Israeli security establishment. The rule of the Shah was crumbling. The rare coalition established between secular and religious opponents of his regime, along with the flagrant corruption and the monarch's obliviousness to the outside world were leading to the imminent demise of the Pahlavi dynasty. But the warnings fell on deaf ears. In the foreign ministry and the Mossad, and in the CIA too, officials were convinced that Merhav and Lubrani were wrong, that the Shah's rule was firm, and that Iran would remain an ally of Israel and the United States forever. It was a grave mistake. From his latest headquarters in Paris, Khomeini directed the mass protests of thousands, which soon became tens and then hundreds of thousands, in cities throughout Iran. On January 16, the Shah, ailing and debilitated, decided that, without American backing, he had best pack up and leave. He took a box with a few clods of Iranian soil and, along with his wife and a handful of aides, he flew to Egypt. The following day, the secular prime minister the Shah had appointed to rule the country, Shapur Bakhtiar, turned to the new head of the Mossad station in Tehran, Eliezer Tzafrir, with a straightforward request. Would the Mossad please kill Khomeini in the Parisian suburb where he was living? The head of the agency, Yitzhak Kofi, called an urgent meeting of his senior staff at headquarters on Tel Aviv's King Saul Boulevard. The benefits for Israel were obvious. The Savak would owe a deep debt of gratitude to the Israelis. Furthermore, it was possible that a hit would divert the course of history and prevent Khomeini, who had made his views on Israel and the Jews quite clear, from seizing power in Iran. The attendees of the meeting discussed several points. Was the plan operationally feasible? Did the Ayatollah actually represent such a grave danger? If so, would Israel be prepared to take upon itself the risks of eliminating a top clerical figure, and to do so on French soil? A representative of Caesarea chief Mike Harari said that from an operational point of view, it was not a complicated matter, but obviously, as in all such operations, especially ones that had to be executed with such limited lead time, things could go wrong. One divisional head who had served in Iran said, "Let Khomeini go back to Iran. He won't last. The military and Savak will handle him and his people protesting in the streets of the cities. He represents Iran's past, not its future." Director Hofi made it clear that he was inclined to turn the request down for reasons of principle, because he was opposed to the use of assassinations against political leaders. Yossi Alfer, the senior research analyst dealing with Iran, told the meeting, "We do not have sufficient information about Khomeini's positions or about his chances of realizing them, and therefore I cannot accurately evaluate whether the risk is justified." Hofi accepted Alfer's opinion and ruled that Tzafrir should give Bakhtiar a negative reply. This episode was another demonstration of how the state of Israel, though often willing to use targeted killings as a tool, remains very hesitant when it comes to killing political leaders, even if they have not officially been designated as such. Looking back, Alfer would say that as early as a couple of months after that meeting, I realized what he, Khomeini, was all about, and that he was very sorry about the decision. If the Mossad had killed Khomeini, according to Alfer, history might have taken a better course. On February 1, Khomeini landed in Tehran's Mehrabad International Airport, greeted by triumphant rejoicing such as Iran had never before witnessed. By the strength of his taped voice alone, Khomeini crumbled the Shah's monarchy. The dream of an Islamic republic became reality. With almost no use of force, Khomeini and his supporters seized control of Iran, a vast country rich in natural resources, with the sixth largest military force in the world and the largest arsenal in Asia. "Islam has been dying or dead for 1,400 years," Khomeini said in his first speech as supreme leader. "We have resurrected it with the blood of our youth. Very soon we will liberate Jerusalem and pray there." As for the government of Shapur Bakhtiar, who had been appointed prime minister by the Shah before he left, Khomeini dismissed it with one short, sharp statement: "I will break their teeth." The United States, the great Satan, as Khomeini thundered, and Israel, the little Satan, saw the Ayatollah's rise as a passing episode. After all, American and British intelligence services had restored the Shah to power once before, after left-wing rebels deposed him in 1953. But Khomeini's rise was the culmination of years of foment, girded by enormous popular support and protected by seasoned, sophisticated lieutenants who identified and crushed all attempts at counter-revolution. In November, a mob of angry student supporters of Khomeini broke into the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, occupied it, and took the diplomats and other workers there hostage. They also seized a vast trove of American intelligence material. The ensuing crisis and the abject failure of a rescue attempt, Operation Eagle Claw, humiliated the United States and contributed to Carter's failure to win re-election. "We felt helpless in the face of this new threat," said Robert Gates, at the time a senior official at the Office of Strategic Research of the CIA, and later CIA Chief and Secretary of Defense. It was clear to both Washington and Jerusalem that what was once their closest ally in the Middle East was now their bitterest enemy. It also soon became clear that Khomeini's vision was not restricted to the Islamic Republic that he declared in Iran. Rather than clinging tenuously to power, the Ayatollah was determined to spread his Islamic revolution throughout the Middle East. He intended to begin with Lebanon. One of Khomeini's closest allies during his years in exile, a Shiite cleric named Ali Akbar Modashamipur, was given the mission of spreading the revolution. He first met Khomeini when studying in Najaf, a city holy to Shiites in Iraq, where the Ayatollah had found refuge after being expelled by the Shah. He accompanied him throughout his years of exile both there and in France. In 1973, Khomeini had sent him, together with a group of other loyal associates, to the Middle East to establish links with Muslim liberation movements in the region. It was Modashamipur who wove the alliance with the PLO that led to the acceptance of Khomeini's men into the training bases of Force 17. At the training bases, PLO experts taught young men the arts of sabotage, intelligence operations, and terror tactics. For Arafat, having Khomeini's men train at his bases was a way to acquire support for the Palestinian cause and to make himself into an international figure. But for Khomeini and Modashamipur, it was part of a long, focused strategy to eventually extend the Islamic revolution they were fomenting in Iran to Lebanon, a small country in the heart of the Middle East with a large population of impoverished Shiites ripe for incitement. Khomeini wanted to stake out a forward strategic position that brought us close to Jerusalem, Lebanon's border with Israel. By 1979, hundreds of Shiites were being trained as a guerrilla army. When Khomeini returned to Iran and seized power, Modashamipur took a central role in the formation of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the force that preserved Khomeini's rule inside the country. Before the Iranian Revolution, the ideal of an Islamic state was an abstract desire, remote from reality. But now, men who had spent their lives in the extremist Muslim colleges of Iran and training camps in Lebanon had become the lords of the land. Almost 3 years after the fall of the Shah, with the revolution firmly established in Tehran, Khomeini named Modashamipur Iran's ambassador to Syria. That post came with two roles. Overtly, he was an emissary of his country's foreign ministry, like all other ambassadors. Covertly, he was also a senior member of the Revolutionary Guards, receiving direct orders from Khomeini and commanding a huge number of personnel and a budget of millions of dollars per month. That second, secret role was by far the more important of the two. At the time, though, much of Lebanon was controlled by the Syrian military. In order for his revolutionary forces to operate effectively then, Khomeini needed to broker a deal with Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. That was Modashamipur's job, finessing the diplomacy that would allow a military alliance. Despite their common enemy, Israel, Assad initially was wary of Modashamipur's overtures. The Iranian ambassador was imbued with an unbridled revolutionary zeal. Assad, a secular Arab, feared that the Islamist rage Moteshamipur was inciting would ultimately prove uncontrollable and be turned against his own regime. The political repercussions seemed to outweigh any immediate benefit. But after Israel invaded Lebanon in June 1982, Assad recalculated. The war was a catastrophe not only for Israel, but also for Assad. In the confrontation with Israel, the Syrian forces were dealt a knockout blow. The most devastating damage was sustained by the Syrian Air Force, a source of pride for Assad, who had commanded it in the past and had continued nurturing it. A total of 82 Syrian warplanes were destroyed in 46 hours, while Israel lost just one plane. Assad concluded from the Israeli invasion that Syria would have no chance against Israel on the traditional battlefield, and that it would have to try to inflict damage indirectly. Israel played right into his hands by leaving its forces inside Lebanon. Israel's intent was to ensure quiet for its communities in the north, but in so doing, it merely created another front for itself, exposed and vulnerable to guerrilla attacks. Assad Sr., that is, Hafez, the father of Bashar who would succeed him, was, to my great regret, a clever man, says Meir Dagan, who commanded the Israeli forces in Lebanon at the time. He built up an apparatus for squeezing blood out of Israel without paying a penny. That apparatus was the Iranian-backed Shiite militia that Moteshamipur was so eager to establish. In July 1982, Iran and Syria signed a military alliance that allowed the Revolutionary Guards under Moteshamipur's command to operate in Lebanon. In the open, they gave civilian assistance to the Shiite population, building social and religious institutions such as schools and mosques. They provided welfare aid to the poor and other needy folks, like drug and alcohol addicts, and a relatively high-level health system. Iran was supplying the Lebanese Shiite public with everything that the government of Lebanon, dominated by a combined Sunni and Christian majority, had never given them. In secret, they began to train and arm a guerrilla force that filled the vacuum left by the PLO and, within two decades, would become one of the dominant political and military forces in the Middle East. Sensing the historic importance of the nascent movement, Moteshamipur gave it a grandiose name. He called it Hezbollah, the Party of God. Ahmad Jafir Kassir was a 16-year-old boy born to a poor Shiite family in the tiny Lebanese village of Deir Kanun al-Nar. His parents said that as a child he was alert and perceptive, characteristics which led him to develop into a self-starting and independent youth. As early as 4 years old, he would run past his father to a patch of farmland in order to pick some vegetables and return home before his father had barely set out on the chore. The local mosque soon became his home away from home as Ahmad frequently went there to pray and read the Quran. He was one of the Shiites swept up in the fervor of Hezbollah, and in the autumn of 1982, he was recruited into a covert military division known as Islamic Jihad. Ahmad secretly carried out several military operations against the Israeli enemy. He also used his resourcefulness to move armaments from Beirut to wherever they were necessary to confront the enemy, Israeli troops. On the morning of November 11, just before 7 o'clock, he drove a white Peugeot packed with explosives toward a seven-story building the IDF used as a regional military and government headquarters in the southern city of Tyre. When he got closer, Kassir stepped hard on the accelerator and aimed for the base of the building. Then he blew himself up. The blast destroyed the building and killed 76 Israeli soldiers, border police, and Shin Bet operatives, as well as 27 Lebanese, workers, civilians requiring various permits from the army, and prisoners. It was the first Islamist suicide terrorist attack outside of Iran, and it killed more Israelis than any other such attack before or since. For years, Hezbollah kept its involvement and the identities of those involved a secret. Only later did the militia build a memorial monument to Qasir in his village, publish a letter of appreciation that Supreme Leader Khomeini had written to the family, and declare the date of his death the annual Martyrs' Day. This secrecy was convenient for Israel's defense establishment, which quickly tried to cover up its own enormous negligence in allowing the suicide attack to happen. The head of the Shin Bet on the northern front then was Yossi Ginassar, whose unit was responsible for collecting information and preventing attacks like Qasir's suicide bombing. Ginassar, together with some of his subordinates and senior officers of the IDF, misled the inquiry into the disaster, steering it away from the truth until it came up with the conclusion that the blast had been caused by a technical fault in the gas canisters in the kitchen and not a daring operation by the new militant Shiite organization. But while Ginassar might have been grossly self-serving in this instance, on a larger scale, Israeli intelligence was indeed unaware of the new militant force rising from the smoking ruins of Lebanon. The first terrorist attacks carried out by Hezbollah, gunfire attacks and roadside bombs aimed at military vehicles, were dismissed by Amman and Shin Bet as no more than a tactical nuisance to IDF troops. "We begin to grasp everything only after a time," said Yekutiel Kuti Moore, a senior Amman officer and later the military secretary to Defense Minister Rabin. "We missed the process. Instead of hooking up with the Shiites, we kept up the link with the Christians, and we made the majority of Lebanese our enemies." Even worse, no one at the time recognized the connection between the Iranians and Lebanon's Shiites, that the balance of power was being tipped by Khomeini's revolutionaries, allied with Assad. "For a long time," said David Barkai of Unit 504, "we never realized that the significant activity was coming out of the office of Motashamipur in Damascus." Likewise, Israel's formidable intelligence apparatus was unaware of the shadow army forming around it, made up of both new recruits and seasoned guerrillas, such as Imad Mughniyeh. Born in 1962 to devout Shiites, Mughniyeh grew up in the poor and crowded neighborhoods south of Beirut. His father was a worker at a candy factory in Beirut, recounted Israel spy Amin al-Haj Rumenegi, himself a Shiite. "We were in touch when we were kids. He was very naughty. Later on, I heard he dropped out of school and joined a training camp of Force 17, and the connection between us was broken." In mid-1978, Mughniyeh became a member of Force 17, Yasser Arafat's guards and the Fatah's elite force. Ali Salameh took Mughniyeh under his wing until he was killed by the Mossad in 1979. Mughniyeh wanted to belong to something larger than a local gang in South Beirut, and he wanted action. Salameh and his successors saw in him an able and intelligent person, charismatic and uninhibited. Although they were Palestinian Sunnis and Mughniyeh was a Lebanese Shiite, the interests of both sides intersected. At the time, Khomeini's followers, poor, exiled Iranians and their Lebanese allies, were grateful to the PLO for their hospitality and support. Mughniyeh was acting under the auspices of Force 17, but he also acquired a reputation as the boss of a gang of thugs enforcing Islamic laws and modest conduct in the streets of Beirut, which was then perceived as a bastion of liberal European customs in the heart of the Middle East. Around this time, Israeli intelligence began receiving reports of an extremist, uninhibited psychopath who was kneecapping hookers and drug dealers in Beirut. 3 years later, when the PLO evacuated Beirut, Mughniyeh and his brothers Fuad and Jihad decided to remain in Lebanon and join up with what they rightly saw as the next rising force, Hezbollah. Mughniyeh immediately became one of the organization's most important operatives. For half a year, he headed the detail that guarded Sheikh Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah, the supreme Shiite authority in Lebanon, and Hezbollah's spiritual compass. He also represented the Sheikh at meetings in Motashamipur's office in Damascus, where senior Iranian officials and Syrian intelligence personnel plotted a strategy for Lebanon. The south was occupied by Israel, and some of the rest by the multinational force, American, French, and Italian soldiers, who had been deployed there to try to bring an end to the horrendous civil war ravaging the country. Both the Syrians and the Iranians wanted the occupiers driven out, but neither could afford or win a direct military confrontation. In those meetings, they agreed on a stealth campaign of sabotage and terror. Mughniyeh was put in charge of organizing it. He, along with Mutashamipur, created Islamic Jihad, which recruited Qasir, the boy who blew up the IDF headquarters in Tyre. It was a devastating inaugural strike, and it was only the beginning. Sheikh Fadlallah hinted at what was coming in an article published in a collection of religious essays in February 1983. "We believe that the future has surprises in store," he wrote. "Jihad is bitter and harsh. It will well up from inside by virtue of effort, patience, and sacrifice, and the spirit of willingness to sacrifice oneself." By sacrifice oneself, Fadlallah was referring to the religious sanction given by Khomeini to his young soldiers, some no more than children, who'd been brainwashed into marching forward into certain death through minefields laid by invading Iraqis. Fadlallah took it a step further, granting approval for intentional suicide in the service of jihad. Hezbollah began carrying out suicide operations in Lebanon, and before long Mughniyeh and Hezbollah had perfected the method, turning it into something of an art. On April 18, 1983, one of Mughniyeh's men drove a van through the front door of the American embassy in Beirut, detonating the ton of explosives stuffed inside. The entire front of the building was demolished, and 63 people were killed, including almost all of the members of the CIA station in Lebanon, as well as the agency's senior Middle East expert, Robert Ames. Then, on October 23, suicide bombers drove trucks packed with huge quantities of explosives into two facilities of the multinational force in Beirut and detonated them. At the U.S. Marine Barracks, 241 peacekeepers were killed, and at the French paratroopers' base there were 58 fatalities. Mughniyeh sat atop a high-rise building nearby and watched the proceedings through a telescope. Concrete fragments and body parts fell on the Shin Bet headquarters in Beirut, about a mile away from the burning Marines facility. On November 4, 1983, Nakad Sarbuk, an Israeli border policeman who was guarding an army base in Tyre, saw a suspicious pickup truck speeding in the direction of the base. He opened fire at the vehicle, spraying it with 130 bullets, but failed to stop it. The suicide driver smashed into the base and detonated the 500-kilogram bomb he was carrying. The building housing the Shin Bet's operation on the base crumpled, and surrounding buildings and tents were also hit. 60 people were killed, and another 29 were wounded. If Israel had been able to write off the first Tyre attack almost exactly a year earlier as a technical mishap, by the time of the second bombing in Tyre, this was no longer possible. Thanks to these suicide attacks, which were planned and directed by Mughniyeh, Mutashamipur got almost exactly what he had wanted. The multinational force was disbanded, and Israel withdrew by stages from most of Lebanese territory, until its forces were concentrated in a shallow security zone in the south of the country. After the second attack in Tyre, the Israeli intelligence community also began to grasp that it was facing a new type of enemy, one that posed a significant challenge. Top members of the Mossad, Shin Bet, and various branches of the IDF began contemplating the possibility of once more employing targeted killings, this time against a new adversary. To the Mossad, it was clear that Imad Mughniyeh was the first priority. But they had little intelligence, only a faded photograph, and no idea where to find him. Nevertheless, the Mossad realized that the coordination between Iran and Hezbollah took place in Mutashamipur's Iranian embassy in Damascus, and not in Beirut. At the end of 1983, Mossad director Nahum Admoni gave Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir a red page to sign. The attached dossier included a litany of suicide bombings and other terrorist attacks, including the attacks against the American embassy and the U.S. Marines barracks in Beirut. The name on the red page was Ali Akbar Mutashamipur, the Iranian emissary to Syria, a diplomat officially. This was not a recommendation made casually, and Shamir signed it only after much hesitation and debate. As a rule, Israel abstained from targeting officials of sovereign states, no matter how hostile they were to the Jewish nation. But something had to be done to stop Hezbollah. Someone important, had to die. Shamir signed the red page. The first problem was getting to Mota Shamipur. He spent his time in either Tehran or Damascus, both capitals of target countries, where bayonet did not operate and where Caesarea was not supposed to carry out targeted killings, except in extraordinary cases. Both capitals were considered particularly difficult arenas, crawling with suspicious police and members of the country's secret services. Moreover, the ambassador was always accompanied by an armed bodyguard and a driver. Every proposal that involved getting close to Mota Shamipur, or into the areas he frequented, shooting him, planting a bomb, poisoning, was ruled out, for fear that the operatives would be caught. One option remained, a booby-trapped package delivered by mail. But when the idea was suggested, objections were raised immediately. Israeli intelligence already had extensive experience in the use of such packages. Twice, the method had worked. In the liquidation of the head of Egyptian military intelligence in Gaza, and in that of his colleague, the Egyptian military attaché in Amman, Jordan, in 1956. But in all other cases, German scientists in Egypt, a Nazi war criminal in Damascus, and PLO functionaries all over the world, the parcels either were discovered in time, blew up in the wrong person's hands, or caused only injuries and not death. I told them that it was foolish and even a little infantile, one Caesarea veteran said, that they chose a modus operandi that did not assure the total neutralization of the objective. But the opposition was shut down. A postal explosive was the only option that wouldn't put an agent in unnecessary danger. On February 14, 1984, a large parcel arrived at the Iranian embassy in Damascus, ostensibly mailed by a well-known London publishing house owned by Iranians. The embassy receptionist saw that it was clearly marked personal for His Excellency the Ambassador and passed it on to Mota Shamipur's second-floor office. The emissary's secretary unwrapped it and saw a cardboard box containing a magnificent volume in English about Shiite holy places in Iran and Iraq. She made do with a peek at the binding, then took it into the ambassador's room. Mota Shamipur opened the book, and there was an explosion. The blast tore off one of his ears, his hand, and most of the fingers on his other hand. Shrapnel destroyed one of his eyes. "If I had opened the book like this," he later told an Iranian TV journalist, holding his hands open near his face and neck, "my head would have been blown off. But I put the book on a table and opened it like this." Here he kept his face and body away from the imaginary book, and the blast made a hole in the wall, and my hand was there, inside the wall. And if the book had opened like this, near his face, my face would have been torn off from my neck. The marks on the rest of my body are from the fragments of the explosion. Another mail bomb had gone wrong. The aim of a negative treatment operation is to kill the object, the Caesarea veteran who had objected to the plot said. There's no such thing as half dead. If he remains alive, it means we have failed. Israel did not claim responsibility, but the Iranians had no doubt the Mossad was behind the operation. Even worse, Mota Shamipur was now a symbol for the revolutionary cause, a maimed survivor of Khomeini's holy war. "I was sorry about the regrettable occurrence that world imperialism has caused to happen to you," his friend the Ayatollah wrote to him. "I hope that your health will soon return, and that you will continue your persistent struggle at the front of Islam and the revolution on behalf of the wretched of the world." Moreover, disabling the ambassador had absolutely no effect on Hezbollah's operations, and killing him probably wouldn't have done much more. The attempt on his life had come too late. The ragtag army of impoverished Shiites that Mota Shamipur had begun organizing a decade earlier was, by then, a huge organization. Hezbollah wasn't one man's guerrilla force. It was a movement. The enormous enterprise that Mota Shamipur had launched in Lebanon was already up and running, having enlisted thousands of young Shiites, as well as most of the important Shiite clergy in the land. Israel now had a powerful adversary that was both an Iranian proxy and a legitimate grassroots social movement. Hezbollah clerics, most of them operating and residing in the Shiite villages in southern Lebanon, knew how to combine fanatical, messianic religious fervor with a new type of Lebanese patriotism, which centered on the consolidation of the Shiites and hatred for the Zionist occupier. The most prominent of these local religious leaders during the founding of the movement was Sheikh Regeb Harb, the Imam of Jibshit, a town in southern Lebanon. A brilliant, fiery-eyed cleric, he had received his training in the holy city of Najaf in Iraq, where Khomeini spent much of his exile from Iran, and upon his return he took charge of Hezbollah's propaganda and preaching in the south of the country. Harb was a man of the cloth, not a fighter, but stories about him were reaching Meir Dagan, who argued that Harb was becoming an important religious authority in the south, and he was constantly advocating attacks against Israel and Israelis. Dagan requested authorization to eliminate Harb. Though Harb never took part in terrorist actions against Israel himself, he incited them constantly. And in those years Israel, mired in its battle with Hezbollah and feeling impotent, welcomed every idea for action. Dagan dispatched two Lebanese agents he'd used in past operations of the Front for the Liberation of Lebanon from foreigners, the proxy guerrilla movement Dagan created. On the night of Friday, February 16, 2 days after the blast in the Iranian embassy meant to kill Mota Shamipur, Harb was on his way home in Jibshit. The two Lebanese agents were waiting at a bend in the road, and as Harb slowed down for the curve, they sprayed his car with bullets, making sure that the young leader was dead. Harb was immediately proclaimed a martyr. At the religious colleges in Qom, prayers were held in his memory, and the Grand Ayatollah Hossein Ali Montazeri, one of Iran's top clerics, sent a cable of condolences to his Shiite colleagues in Lebanon, praising Harb's feats. To mark the 100th day after his death, a postage stamp in his memory was issued. His portrait appeared above all the pictures of all the martyrs, whose number was gradually increasing as the years went by. His statement advocating absolute rejection of any contact whatsoever with the Israelis, a stance is a weapon, and a handshake is an acknowledgement, has, since that point, been Hezbollah's primary motto. Meanwhile, Dagan also targeted Mohammed Saad, one of Harb's close associates and another prominent Shiite figure in the south. Saad was a frequent participant in guerrilla activities against Israel and had amassed a huge quantity of weaponry and explosives in the Husseinia, a place of prayer separate from the mosque that he managed in the village of Maraka. On March 4, 1985, Dagan's agents blew up Saad's weapons cache. He and one of his men were killed in the blast along with 13 others. The attempt on Mota Shamipur's life and the elimination of Harb and Saad revealed much about the operational difficulties Israel faced when confronting Hezbollah. The Mossad generally took pains for its targeted killings to be blue and white, the colors of the Israeli flag, or carried out by Israeli operatives, but local agents were used in the killings of Harb and Saad, and the Mossad had to resort to the postal bomb method, long considered inefficient and liable to harm innocent bystanders, in order to try to dispose of Mota Shamipur. These three victims were not senior Hezbollah commanders either. There was almost no information about the top target, Imad Mughniyeh. An attempt to do away with the spiritual compass of the organization 3 days later was no more successful. On March 8, 1985, a car bomb exploded near the home of Sheikh Fadlallah in Beirut. Fadlallah was unhurt, but 80 people were killed and 200 injured, most of them worshippers at the mosque where Fadlallah preached. Some of the Sheikh's bodyguards were killed as well, including Imad Mughniyeh's brother, Jihad. Still, Israel continued to try to solve its Lebanon problem through targeted killings. In 1986, Israeli intelligence discovered that Ahmed Jibril, the commander of the Popular Front General Command Palestinian Terror Organization, was working with and assisting Hezbollah. On the strength of this information, coupled with Israel's long-standing desire to eliminate Jibril, Shamir signed a red page for him. Gathering the intelligence took a long time. Eventually, it was established that Jibril often visited his organization's headquarters in a warren of caves at Nameh, on the Mediterranean coast north of Lebanon's border with Israel. On the night of December 8, 1988, the IDF launched a large-scale land operation aimed at killing Jibril and destroying the network of caves. Operation Blue and Brown, Kachol Vehum, was an embarrassing flop. The intelligence about the target area was dangerously incomplete. The soldiers ran into unexpected natural obstacles, and a lookout post they did not know about spotted them, depriving them of the element of surprise. One of the commanders of the assassination force, a lieutenant colonel, was killed. Four soldiers went astray and had to be extricated later in a complicated Air Force operation. In addition, a trained dog, which was loaded with explosives and was supposed to run into one of the caves where the device on its back would be exploded by remote control, was frightened by the shooting and ran away. Hezbollah later found the animal, which exposed the IDF's secret sting, Oketz, canine unit. Most embarrassingly, Ahmed Jibril wasn't even there that night at all. By the late 1980s, then, Hezbollah had far better intelligence, critical in waging a guerrilla war. One of the reasons for the absence of sufficient intelligence on the Israeli side was that Hezbollah gave Lebanon's downtrodden and beleaguered Shiites a community and a cause. Every attack against it drew its followers closer to the organization, strengthening the distinction between the good guys and the bad in their eyes. This, in turn, made it especially difficult for Israel to recruit live agents. Shiites willing to work for money grew fewer and farther between. Nobody wanted to betray Hezbollah. Imad Mughniyeh used this superior intelligence to devastating effect. Backed by Iran's Revolutionary Guards and Intelligence Ministry, Mughniyeh honed and perfected Hezbollah's battlefield tactics. Suicide bombs and roadside explosions and carefully staged ambushes wreaked havoc on the large and unwieldy IDF forces. The price of having almost zero information about the Shiite militia was paid with the blood of Israeli soldiers. Between 1984 and 1991, there were 3,425 operations against the IDF and the South Lebanon Army, the pro-Israel Lebanese militia set up by the Israelis. Most of these attacks were carried out by the Shiite organization. In these attacks, 98 Israeli soldiers and 134 Lebanese allies were killed, and 447 Israelis and 341 Lebanese were wounded. Two Israeli MIAs were later discovered to have been killed as well. Frustrated by their weak position, in 1991 Israel's intelligence operatives began looking for what they termed the tiebreaker, the symbolic attack that would rock Hezbollah to its foundation and give Israel back its edge. Chapter 22. The Age of the Drone. The imams in the village of Jibshit began calling people to the Husseinia at 10 o'clock in the morning. The Husseinia is a Shiite meeting hall, named for the Imam Hussein, the son of Ali, cousin of the Prophet Muhammad, and founder of Shia Islam. Shiites believe that Ali was the true heir to Muhammad and that his inheritance was brutally usurped by the Sunnis. The Shia became a sect that was oppressed and discriminated against. In the Husseinia, they would hold their religious rites in secret for fear of the Sunnis. But on that day in Jibshit, there was no longer any need for secrecy. Iran had become the first country in the world ruled by Shiite clergy. In Lebanon, the extremist Shiite Hezbollah, founded by Iran, was the predominant political and military force. The Husseinia in Jibshit, abutting the imposing village mosque on the main street, had been renovated and expanded, its walls lined with shining white marble. For 7 years, the call had come from the loudspeakers in the mosque's minarets every February 16, the anniversary of the death of Sheikh Raghib Harb, the first spiritual leader of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. By assassinating him in 1984, Israel had unintentionally created a martyr, and the leaders and commanders of Hezbollah made annual pilgrimages to his memorial before attending a political rally. By 10:30, the main street was crowded with men and women, all of whom had set aside whatever they were doing, locked up their homes or stores or offices, and made their way to the Husseinia. They moved slowly, following two SUVs, one gray and the other black, apparently a Hezbollah security escort. At about 9,500 feet above the streets of Jibshit, a camera in the nose of a small, quiet aircraft panned the length of the procession. There was no pilot, but rather an operator controlling the plane from a trailer on the northern border in Israel. The images from the camera, in high resolution and real time, were beamed to a screen in the small Amman war room overlooking a rose garden outside the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv. It was, in 1992, a marvel of intelligence technology. A drone that put Israeli eyes on a surveillance target without risking any Israeli personnel. The drone's camera continued the length of the procession. At the end, four vehicles were clearly visible, two Range Rovers and two Mercedes sedans. In Tel Aviv, intelligence officials watched as those four slipped away from the crowd, past the Husseinia, and stopped in a parking lot behind the building. "We've got him," one of the analysts watching the video feed said. 200 miles away, intelligence operatives had a clear view of a target. Suddenly, an internal review of that morning later reported, the scent of a hunt was in the air. Ever since the opening offensive of the Yom Kippur War, which had taken the Israelis completely by surprise, Major General Benjamin Beni Peled, the commander of the Israeli Air Force, had been haunted by failure. At the beginning of the war, in 1973, the Air Force had received more than half of the defense budget, and yet it completely collapsed during the initial Egyptian and Syrian attack. Peled believed that one of the main reasons for the failure was that important intelligence had reached him too late. If he'd known Egyptian forces were launching, if he could have seen in real time the preparations, his own forces would have been better able to respond. In the aftermath of that assault, Peled decided to develop a network of secret communications and real-time intelligence gathering systems. It would be designed to serve the Air Force independent of the Greens, as the Blues of the IAF somewhat condescendingly called the ground forces because of their olive-drab uniforms. Using aircraft for that end would have been the obvious plan, but that was complicated by another trauma of the Yom Kippur War. The IAF had lost more than a quarter of its warplanes, and many of the rest were damaged and unfit for action. Furthermore, many of the IAF's airmen, who until then had enjoyed an aura of invincibility, had been shot down and taken prisoner or killed. But what if airplanes didn't need pilots? Or the multi-million-dollar munitions systems? What if, Peled wondered, the IAF could remotely pilot smaller, cheaper aircraft equipped with only cameras and communications links? A decade earlier, when he ran the weapons department, Peled was the first to introduce drones into the Air Force, although at the time, it seemed a fantastical idea. He was worried about the Arab forces' acquisition of Soviet-made surface-to-air anti-aircraft missiles, and as a result, he wanted to fill the air with decoys that would be very cheap and with similar profiles as fighter planes on their radar screens. These UAVs, an Israeli improvement on an American invention, were launched by rockets, and in order to return to the ground, they would eject a parachute, which a helicopter with long poles fixed to its fuselage would then sweep up. Later, the drones were also equipped with cameras. But after the 1973 war, Peled reached the conclusion that this was not enough. The launch and recovery systems were costly, clumsy, and very dangerous. Processing the photographed material took a long time, too. Hours elapsed between taking the pictures, developing the film, and finally transferring the photos to the intelligence analysts. And so, in the wake of the 1973 defeat, a new type of drone was developed. This drone could take off and land independently. It was controlled from a command caravan, and it had cameras that transmitted video footage in real time. By 1982, drones were a key element in providing real-time intelligence for the top Air Force brass sitting in Canary, the command post deep underground in central Tel Aviv. They also played a key role in knocking out Syrian anti-aircraft missile batteries in Lebanon. The drone that targeted Syrian defenses was the first model of the Scout, known in Israel as the Zahavan, made by Israel Aerospace Industries. The Israeli Air Force, hoping to convince the United States to cooperate in drone development, wanted to demonstrate to the Americans how effective its miniature, pilotless planes could be. When U.S. Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger visited the Middle East, first Beirut and then Tel Aviv, he met with the top IDF and Defense Ministry officials. He was then shown a video taken by an Israeli drone of his arrival in Beirut and the movements of his motorcade in the Lebanese capital. Weinberger didn't much appreciate the surveillance, but the members of his entourage were very impressed with the technology. Weinberger's visit to Israel paved the way for a huge deal between Israel Aerospace Industries and the Pentagon for the sale of 175 upgraded Scout UAVs, which were given the name Pioneer in the United States. They were used by the U.S. Navy, Marines, and Army until 2007. Improvements to the drones were made over the years to allow them to carry more fuel and to update the cameras. In 1990, Israel equipped its drone fleet with lasers so that they could emit a beam and designate a static target for warplanes. The upgrades to the drones were part of a larger technological push in the IDF, which, in the late 1980s, invested significant resources to acquire and develop precision ordnance, smart bombs, that could hit their targets more accurately, making them more effective and less likely to inflict collateral damage. This process was accelerated when technology buff Ehud Barak, who wanted to build a small, smart army, became chief of staff in 1991, in effect shaping the Israeli war machine for the coming decades. Under his direction, the IAF's Apache attack helicopters were equipped with laser-guided Hellfire missiles. At the same time, a meeting between the heads of the IAF Operations Department and Arya Weisbrot, commander of the 1st IAF Drone Unit, Squadron 200, came up with the revolutionary idea of combining all of these technological advances into a single five-step process to create a new and particularly deadly method of targeted killing. First, a drone would track a moving target, either a person or a vehicle. Second, the drone would transmit an image of the target directly to the operational command, providing a real-time connection with the decision-makers right up until the order to fire. Third, the drone would designate the target with a laser beam that could be picked up by an Apache helicopter's laser detector, a stage known as passing the baton, from the intelligence gathering cycle to the operational cycle. Fourth, the Apache's own laser would mark the target, which a Hellfire missile could then lock onto. Fifth, the Apache pilot would fire the missile and destroy the target. Combining and synchronizing both systems, intelligence and operations, was a major breakthrough. Drones already had proven themselves invaluable in gathering information. But now, they'd evolved from a support role into a direct combat tool. Squadron 200 began training with the Apache pilots of Squadron 113, the WASP squadron, in late 1991. There were skeptics in the IAF, especially among pilots who'd been trained in and had long practiced specific combat tactics. The idea that flying robots could be effective in war seemed, to some, preposterous. But in December 1991, they tried a number of dry runs using vehicles on Israel's roads as targets. Three or four drones were launched, and a vehicle selected at random for them to track with their cameras transmitting everything to the control caravan. Then the vehicle was lit up with a laser beam, and after a few miles the chase was joined by two Apaches, and the whole team would practice passing the baton, as the Apache's sensors would lock onto the drone's laser beam. At the moment the Apache indicated that the target was locked, the exercise ended. But simulating missile fire onto cars on a friendly road was one thing. Killing a live target in hostile territory was something else altogether. On a routine bombing run in southern Lebanon in October 1986, a bomb dropped by an F-4 Phantom exploded too early and ripped off one of the plane's wings. The two airmen ejected and landed in enemy territory. The pilot was rescued by an IAF Cobra helicopter, but not before hanging from the undercarriage under fire from Hezbollah militiamen. The navigator, Ron Arad, could not be located. Israelis attach great importance to the Jewish religious injunction of redemption of captives, and it is an Israeli fixation to do everything and more to get MIAs and POWs home. Losing an airman to Hezbollah in hostile territory was a tremendous blow. Not surprisingly, then, the search for Arad was massive, the largest rescue operation in Israeli history. A Mossad official who was involved in Operation Body Heat, Hom Haguf, the code name for the effort to find Arad, said it was the biggest search operation ever conducted in modern history for a single person. There was no stone that we left unturned, no source that we didn't enlist, no bribe that we didn't pay, and no scrap of information that we didn't scrutinize. It all came to nothing. Arad was passed from one militia to another year after year. In 1989, 3 years after Arad had disappeared, Israel abducted two relatively minor Hezbollah officials in an attempt to locate the airmen. One of them, Abdal Karim Obeid, was the man who had been named to succeed Sheikh Rageb Harb as Hezbollah's chief cleric in southern Lebanon after Harb was killed. Their interrogation revealed nothing, and Hezbollah responded with indifference to an offer to begin negotiations for an exchange. The search for Arad was partially hobbled by errors and oversights, as well as simple bad luck. Mostly, though, the continuous search highlighted Israel's inability to penetrate Hezbollah or the Iranian intelligence agencies that supported the organization. More broadly, the militia was now carrying out increasingly sophisticated guerrilla actions, orchestrated by its military chief, Imad Mughniyeh, inflicting casualties and severe damage to the morale of the IDF. Finally, in the summer of 1991, Amman top brass worked out a plan to shift the balance in Israel's favor. Israel would abduct Hezbollah Secretary General Hussein Abbas al-Musawi, or one of his two deputies, and hold him hostage until Ron Arad was returned. A concomitant goal was to stage an emblematic operation that would reverberate and clarify who was really in charge of the situation, in the words of one of the Israeli officers involved. Musawi was one of the poor Shiites the Iranians began organizing in the 1970s. He also underwent guerrilla training in a PLO 417 camp before becoming more devout and devoting years to studying Shia theology, first in Lebanon and then in Muslim colleges in Najaf, in Iraq, which were run by disciples of Khomeini in accordance with his religious precepts. His astute mind, excellent memory, and loyalty to Khomeini, which matched his fanaticism, soon made him a well-known religious authority in Iraq and Lebanon and led him to become one of the core founders of Hezbollah. Musawi, according to information gathered by the Israelis, was involved in the decisions that allowed Imad Mughniyeh to begin his campaign of suicide terrorism against the United States and Israel. He believed that one of Hezbollah's main aims, although not the primary one, should be the expulsion of the IDF by means of guerrilla warfare. "The future will be for the resistance against the Israeli occupation," he repeatedly declared in his speeches, "while arrogance of the Israelis will be defeated. It is only a matter of time." In May 1991, he became Secretary General of Hezbollah,